Well, greetings and welcome to The Dividing Line on a Thursday. I've got a... Oh, there we had a pixelated dead screen, and there it is. Good to have you with us. We're going to be taking some phone calls later on in the program at 877-753-3341. I was directed to a hit piece this morning that I wanted to respond to very quickly, and then we have some comments to make on certain events since Tuesday, and then we'll get to your phone calls. So one individual on Twitter had said that needed some help with a challenge that had been given to them by Jehovah's Witnesses. So said, well, we'll probably be taking some phone calls, so I'd invite that person especially to call in. I don't know who Alan Rule is. I did some quick, just very quick looking around. There's a Jenny Rule that's written some books in Amazon on low-carb diets, and nothing at all on YouTube, debates, lectures, nothing. But he has written, James White is extremely dishonest and should not be taken seriously. Alan Rule is a Romanist, and he's a Romanist who engages with Muslims. Ah, start putting that together and you start seeing maybe why this is going on, because I have been very clear in saying to my Muslim friends, Roman Catholicism does not represent biblical Christianity. It's a completely different message, different gospel. the exaltation of Mary in Roman Catholicism, you know, half the time that I engage with my Muslim friends in regards to texts such as Surah 5:116, they end up going back to Roman Catholicism as an illustration of taking Jesus and his mother as gods besides Allah. And interestingly enough, Mr. Rule doesn't mention this, but I have even though I clearly view and have proven and defended in debate against people who actually do write books and stuff on from the Roman Catholic side, the reality that view of Mary is idolatrous, it is not biblical. Even though I do that, I also have to correct my Muslim friends and point out that even Rome very carefully says Mary is not deity. Now, they blur the lines. They're the ones that have done it. They have no biblical basis for doing it. But I've tried to be accurate about that as well. Well, why am I extremely dishonest and should not be taken seriously? Well, he talks about, to all Muslims who read this blog, please pay attention because we all need to expose the dishonesty of this man. Ooh. Christians and Muslims, I don't know why he doesn't capitalize Muslims. Why don't you capitalize Muslims? I wonder if they find that disrespectful. Christians capitalize, but Muslims aren't. Anyway. Christians and Muslims both value honesty, so we should make it our goal to show that James White embraces the same inconsistency of which he accuses Muslims. First of all, I don't see why Muslims would watch Catholic versus Protestant debates, so I can understand why they wouldn't have seen this, but they'll be surprised to know that White is a huge hypocrite on the issue of using liberal scholars in debate. In 2008, when James White and Shabir Ali debated on Muhammad in the Bible, Ali quoted many liberals, including Raymond Brown. White spent almost the whole debate trying to point out it is inconsistent to try to use liberal scholarship to try to make supernatural claims. I agree with this, but the problem with White is that he has no problems when doing this with Catholicism. In 2001, he debated Father Peter Stravinskas on the Doctrine of Purgatory. In this debate, he employed the tactics he condemns when used by Islamic apologists. The debate can be found here, at least provide a link. At the 45-minute mark, he says, hence, as Roman Catholic McBride admits, there is, for all practical purposes, no biblical basis for the doctrine of purgatory. This is not to say there is no basis for at all for the doctrine, but only that there is no clear biblical basis for it. When I first heard this statement, I couldn't believe what I was hearing. James White has the audacity to quote this ultra-liberal scholar Richard McBride to a Catholic opponent to make a point, but when Shabir Ali quotes E.P. Sanders, Rudolf Bultmann, or Raymond Brown, it's a big deal. That is complete hypocrisy for someone who claims to be a Christian. No, that's a demonstration, sir, that you don't have a clue how to think clearly. You don't know what categories are, and you don't know what context is either. Might explain why you're a Romanist apologist, but let's put this one to bed and do it quickly. Who was I debating? Father Peter Stravinskis. Huh, Peter Stravinskis. Well, where did Peter Stravinskis get his two earned doctorates? Ivy League schools. Huh, you think there's just a small chance that at every school that Stravinskis taught at and every school where he learned, people like McBrien and these others, Raymond Brown, were the biggest names possible? Let's try something else, Mr. Rule, since you seem to be such a conservative Catholic. How about the fact that your current Pope is just as liberal as either one of them? How about the fact that it's your popes that keep putting these people on the Catholic biblical commissions? Maybe when I'm debating a Roman Catholic who is defending the current papacy using the current standards of the papacy might be a good idea. What do you think? And do you think that might be just a little bit different than the situation of a Muslim who accepts a supernatural worldview, believes the moon has been split, believes Muhammad flew on a winged beast from Jerusalem up through heaven and back again? You think maybe the level of inconsistency and the character of the inconsistency and the kind of the inconsistency is completely different because of the context? Yeah, well, so I am quote-unquote dishonest because I actually use the sources that my opponent would be the one who's utilizing. And that somehow is, he just completely misses the category difference between that and dealing with a Shabir Ali who continually says, scholars, standard over here, different standard, different scholars over here when I'm defending the Quran or coming up with the argument for the number 19 in the Quran or whatever else it might be. Has nothing to do with this dishonesty, has nothing to do with inconsistency. It has to do with the fact that Mr. Rule seemingly cannot follow category errors or just simply commits them very badly. So I found that fascinating that a Roman Catholic, this makes me sick. The temperature of my response is directly correlated to the temperature of his absurd attack. And I hope if any Muslims had seen that, let me repeat it one more time. Roman Catholicism is not biblical Christianity. Roman Catholicism has a different gospel. And I think most Muslims can see that. I think especially if Muslims obtain any level of familiarity with the New Testament, they can see that the simple, pure faith of the New Testament, the worship of the New Testament church, the organization of the New Testament church, all they got to do is compare that with what they see in the Vatican or what they see with the current Pope and his perspectives and his viewpoints and his worldview. Massive difference. No two ways about it. But there are massive distinction between those who hold to sola scriptura and those who do not. It is interesting, leaving that behind now, it is interesting to look at the distinctions amongst Muslims and sort of try to draw parallels. I was explaining Sufism, or at least elements of Sufism, to some folks, and when I used the term charismatic, a lady started laughing in the audience. It really struck her as funny, but there are Muslims who have a much higher view of the later tradition, and then Muslims that reject that. Can you really draw a parallel that to the Reformation and things like that? Not really. You've got very, very different situations. You've got pretty much a governmental control in Islam at the beginning over against the persecution of the Christians by the Roman Empire for hundreds of years. Really, I don't see any benefit whatsoever to trying to make the parallel, because there's just too many differences, too many differences. But some people do, and it doesn't work out real well. Before I go to the phones, some of the stuff, you know, last week, started with Donald Trump and his comments about transgender bathrooms and Trump Tower and all that kind of stuff. Then a few days later, this just didn't seem to hit big. And I'm not really sure why, but former senator, and let's see, Democrat from Pennsylvania, Senator Harris Wofford. Senator Harris Wofford has announced that he will be marrying a man 50 years his junior next weekend, which would have been this past weekend, 20 years after his wife's death. Did you see this? Yeah. Wofford is 90. So he's marrying a 40-year-old man 20 years after his wife passed away. And he is a former Democratic senator from the state of Pennsylvania. When I first saw it, I the first thing you have to do is check the source. Is this The Onion? Or, you know, now there's dozens of Onion type sites. At least some of them are straight up front and really easy to recognize. And then of course we have the new already classic Christian satire website, the Babylon Bee, which I've already appeared on a couple of times, the Babylon Bee. Comes from Fox News, which sometimes can be a little weird, but I you don't even know what to say anymore when you have article after article after article that is nothing more than the written evidence of the stench of a dead and decaying society. That's what it is. It is obviously to me a horrific insult to the memory of this man's wife. But once you have destroyed all meaningful ethical and moral categories, once you have destroyed the very meaning of what marriage is, once everything has become just about me, 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 my feelings, my emotions, my etc. Once there's no longer any objective morality, then this kind of stuff is just going to become second nature. And I pray that it'll continue to grieve me, but honestly, when it just becomes a daily type thing, eventually numbness sets in. And what's, you know, our grandchildren are just going to be so surrounded by this. How can they not be deeply impacted by it to where it becomes the norm, where that's just the way that it is? It amazes me. It really does. At the same time, we noticed that, well, on a Roman Catholic campus, this is an article dated the 27th, so this is yesterday. Jesuit University Loyola, Marymount University in Los Angeles, called the Los Angeles Police Department. Both the police and the university's bias incident response team bias incident response team. It means that's Bert. You know, Bert used to be a character on Sesame Street. Now Bert is the bias incident response team, also known as the Thought Police. Both the police and the university's bias incident response team are investigating the stated belief that only two genders exist, male and female, as a hate crime. So a conversation took place on campus on a Jesuit campus, and someone who actually still believes in what the Jesuits have always taught said to someone else that you're either male or female, and they denied transgenderism. Call the cops. Call the cops. Utter totalitarianism. Utter totalitarianism. You will think like us. You will act like us. All liberty? No. No. Only for us. Only if you look like us. Only if you talk like us. Absolutely amazing. Of course, then we have the story from NC State. Want to talk about Jesus? You'll need a permit for that. Need a permit for that. A permit is required before students can talk about Jesus at North Carolina State University, according to a lawsuit filed in federal court. Grace Christian Life, a registered student group at NC State, filed suit over a policy requiring a permit for any kind of student speech or communication anywhere on campus, including religious speech. This is the former United States of America. Can we get around to recognizing that now? This is the former United States of America. It's not the United States of America I grew up in. A revolution has taken place. Thankfully, it was mainly, well, I was about to say it was a bloodless coup. That's the terminology that's used. And that's true in the sense that there was not warfare in the streets. There were not armed parties. But we dare not say that it was without bloodshed. Because you need to understand that one of the central platforms of the revolution was erotic freedom, and one of the central pillars in the temple of erotic freedom and human autonomy is abortion. So it wasn't bloodless. Millions, more than 50 million, had to be sacrificed on the altar of Moloch to bring about the absolute desensitization and the dehumanization of the very nation that had won World War II. Other nations suffered greatly. Suffered far more than we did. I mean, but it was our military might and our military power that defeated the Germans and the Japanese. Nobody else had the equipment. Nobody else had that kind of manufacturing capacity. We couldn't do that anymore. There's no way this nation could win a war like that any longer. Couldn't happen. I'm not just talking about militarily. It's a cultural thing. I've seen these memes. You've seen them too. Comparing the 18-year-olds in combat gear getting ready to jump off of landing craft at Normandy versus the safe space warriors today. And there is no comparison. And the safe space warriors are not liberating the world from anything. There's no connection between the two. And there is far more truth to that than we might want to understand. But the campuses, the universities, the totalitarians are really just, they're not even bothering to pretend any longer. You will think like us. You will talk like us. First Amendment doesn't hold here. There is no religious freedom. The only freedom you have is erotic freedom. The only freedom you have is to act like us and talk like us, and everything else will be silenced. We are totalitarians. They're not even bothering to hide it anymore. They don't figure anyone cares. They've won the war, and there you go. There you go. And so this kind of stuff is absolutely all around us, and it is shocking. 877-753-3341, 877-753-3341. It does seem to me that for all intents and purposes, the election, as far as the primaries, is over. And now there's still, I just still wonder. What if, maybe, possibly, the FBI does what the FBI has to do? Because as far as I can tell, remember General Petraeus? General Petraeus got into a lot of trouble. He will have to be apologized to if there is not an indictment handed down against Hillary Clinton. And part of me wants to say that will change everything. And then another part of me goes, that'll change nothing. It'll change nothing. I honestly have become so jaded, so skeptical, that I honestly think that they would just press on and say, just no one cares about emails. You know, just because this exposed our nation to, you know, put lives in danger, maybe even cost lives, no one really cares. And it all goes back to the public sector unions. And I honestly don't believe my vote counts any longer. I think the system is broken. All I know is the news channels would love it. They could go wall to wall and just make all sorts of money in the process. And it does make me wonder. But we'll see what happens. We'll see what happens. I'm just sort of watching from the outside any longer, to be perfectly honest with you. I've mentioned this before. Just be very brief, as we've got phone lines lined up, and I don't see the one caller about Jehovah's Witnesses, so hopefully we'll be able to get them on if they've tried calling. We'll go ahead and go to the callers here. We won't worry about anything else. I have to say 877-753-3341, 877-753-3341 is the phone number, and let's start with Austin. Hi, Austin. Hello, Austin. Hello, Austin. I can't hear anything.
Hello?
Oh,
hello?
There he is.
Hey, sorry, I'm having a hard time hearing. Can you hear me?
Yes, I can hear you.
Okay, how you doing today?
Just fine.
So I had a question about the regulative principle of worship. I'm a relatively new believer, about 3 years or so through your ministry. I came to discover the doctrines of grace, and now I consider myself a Reformed Baptist, but I go to school at UNC Chapel Hill, and I'm going to a Reformed Presbyterian church up here.
Do you have a permit? Austin, do you have a permit to be calling me right now?
Well, you know what? My friends over at NC State would definitely need a permit if they were calling you on campus.
That is amazing.
It is. I saw the news article yesterday. I couldn't believe it.
Okay, so you're going to a Reformed, you said Reformed Presbyterian Church?
Right. Yeah, I think you're familiar with Dr. Rosaria Butterfield.
Oh, yeah, sure.
Yeah, yeah, it's her and her husband are at that church. Her husband's a pastor there, and they are exclusive psalmody a cappella singers.
Uh-huh.
And so they've been kind of talking to me about some of that stuff and sharing their beliefs. And so I just wanted to start out just by asking you, I think from some of the comments that I've heard you make on The Dividing Line, you do hold to the regulative principle.
Well, yeah, I do, but you need to understand that regulative principle is interpreted in a number of ways.
Right.
In general, the concept is that worship is not something that God has left up to us just to do as we see fit, as we feel is appropriate, et cetera, that he has laid out guidelines as to what his worship is to consist of. Now, obviously, the great controversy that has existed really since time of the Reformation primarily is, well, but how do you interpret the scriptures in regards to what has and has not been commanded? And so
right.
Some of the areas of differences have to do with, what you've mentioned two areas, the utilization of instruments in Christian worship, and the singing of something other than the Psalter. And generally, the vast majority of those who came out of the Reformation accepted that while God has definitely given guidelines for how he is to be worshipped, and so in other words, the fact that the central aspect of worship is the proclamation of his truth, there is singing, there is prayer, there isn't liturgical dance or the utilization of Hollywood rock stars, that type of thing. The specifics do tend to, the majority have not taken quite as strict a view as that. In regards to exclusive psalmody, there's, you know, I've got lots of good friends that are exclusive psalmists. I am not. I don't believe that that you can, and I've heard all the arguments, but I don't believe you can turn psalms, hymns, and spiritual songs into psalms, and psalms. And the strongest argument I've ever heard, extra-biblical argument I've ever heard on the subject is quite simply this. It is difficult to imagine that it was the intention of the apostles to teach us that we could never sing a song that would specifically have in it the name of Jesus. And it seems very clear to me that we do have a fragment of a hymn in Philippians 2:5-11. And if we do, then that in and of itself would be scriptural refutation of the idea. Why would you be writing hymns to the church if you weren't going to be singing them in worship? So my exclusive psalmist friends try to say it's actually not a hymn. And since Jesus is Jehovah and Jehovah's name appears in the Psalms, and you can sing that. But obviously it was the manifestation of Jesus in the flesh as Jesus that I'm talking about when I refer to that. And then as far as musical, I'm sorry, go ahead.
I'm looking a little bit more at this point at the instrument side of things.
Right, I was about to get to that.
I know that they would classify that as, like, you would be violating the elements of worship if you use instruments. I went on, like, some of the Founders Church's websites, and they classify those as, like, a circumstance of worship. Do you have an opinion on that?
Well, that one's strange. If you have exclusive psalmody, the psalms themselves refer to using instruments. So you have to really start bending stuff to try to fit all of this together, because very clearly, it's interesting, my fellow elder, when we first went to Phoenix Reformed Baptist Church, I remember the first time I heard him read a psalm that contained the term Selah, and he would read it. And I had never heard anyone read Selah before.
Yeah.
I found that, and he still does. And I guess sometimes when I read the Psalms, I do too, but sometimes I don't, because most of us believe that Selah was a metric or song indicator, a change of tune or key or something. It had something to do with the fact that these were actually songs. And the Psalms themselves contain references to the instruments that are to be used with it. And so if that was acceptable, then on what principle do you then say, No, it's, you know, for example, I do personally miss when I'm in a church where the hymnals have been replaced with a projection system.
Yeah.
I miss the ability to sing parts and harmony in the songs because I can't. If I don't have the music, I can't. I can guess at the bass part, but and some songs I already know the bass part, so I can do it then. But most of the time, I just sort of have to sing along with everybody else, and I can't really participate on that particular level. So there are instances where having a piano, for example, absolutely necessary for keeping everybody together and keeping going the right direction and getting us all started in the right key. And there are times when we don't have our piano player at PRBC. And I hate when that happens when I'm the one preaching and I don't have my fellow elder to help, because there have been a couple times getting that hymn started was an absolute disaster. It was almost distracting, to be perfectly honest with you, because, you know, I just remember this one where, you know, I'm looking at the notes and for some reason the last hymn just blew the next tune out of my mind. And we got about half a thing into it and we all stopped, and finally, eventually one guy down front got a start in the right tune, but he's this big, huge dude. And so he was about 14 octaves below any of the rest of us could do. So it was funny. Anyways, a little personal story there, but, I understand, I would rather have people concerned about these issues than apathetic, about these issues. So I suppose if it's got to be one way or the other, I'd rather have the concern. At the same time, unfortunately, I have encountered some folks who could get a little bit aggressive about it.
And, yeah, as have I.
And so there's a balance in there someplace. But
you would view that maybe as something that's at the discretion of the elders of the local congregation.
Oh yeah, I most definitely. I think the elders of the congregation should be convinced about it. Should be able to give a response for it and say, here's where we stand on this. And obviously, we have good relationships with churches that would differ with us on that, because we're not exclusive psalmody. We do sing a lot of psalms. We probably sing more psalms than a lot of people would at all be comfortable with. But we're not exclusive psalmists. So, and we do have a piano. We have an organ too, but it's been dead longer than I've been at the church. And it's slowly disappearing because the kids are slowly cannibalizing little pieces off of it. So it's really sort of humorous that we're all watching this happen over time. But we also have an overhead projector over in the corner of the Bible study room that has not moved literally for about 30 years. So that's just Reformed Baptists are just that way.
So just real quickly to play devil's advocate for them on there, you're talking about the use of the instruments in Old Testament worship. I've had them say to me that those instruments were used in connection with the sacrificial system when they were in worship, and since Christ, those things pointed to Christ,
what'd they do? Whack the lamb over the head with the harp? I'm sorry.
About how they blow the trumpet during sacrifice.
I know. I'm sorry. I don't. There is a tremendous. For example, I think there's a pretty fatal argument against that. The ascent psalms were sung on the way to Jerusalem for worship, but there were instruments used with them. They weren't even in the temple yet. So I just don't see any connection, any meaningful connection between those instruments and the sacrificial system at all.
Okay.
I just don't see it.
All right.
So. All righty.
Well, thanks very much, Dr. White.
Hey, thanks, Austin. I appreciate it. God bless. Bye-bye. 877-753-3341. Let's talk with Jeremy. Hi, Jeremy.
Hey, Dr. White. How you doing?
Doing good.
So I have a question in regards to the Church of Christ. My coworker recently left from a Catholic church with his wife, and I got to get him to go to a solid Baptist church for a while. And recently, his wife forced him to leave the church because she rejects original sin.
Oh.
And so right after they left, they joined the Church of Christ. And when he told me, I tried orchestrating a meeting with the two of them to talk to them over this issue. But his wife told the elders of the church, and they basically told him to shun me at work. And
is this,
I'm just asking,
let me ask you a question, Jeremy. Is this, would this happen to be the International Churches of Christ?
Yeah, the ICC.
Yeah, okay. Yeah. Need to include that in there, because the old line Church of Christ groups, mm-hmm. some down south could be that aggressive. But as soon as you said that, it sounded to me like an ICC issue, because they tend to be quite cultic.
Yeah, no, I'm scared for him, because, I mean, he recently left the Roman Catholic Church, and I've been trying to pour into him the Reformed faith.
Yeah.
And, you know, his wife totally rejects original sin, and I really, really, you know, wanted to talk to them about that issue and tell them that the scriptures are very clear about that, and they're basically, you know, wanting to shun me. And I'm scared for my friend, because, I mean, he really respects my decision. I told him, like, bro, like, within your, you know, church's theology, I'm not saved. And, like, he was really, like, flustered at that. And I'm just wanting to come to you to get, you know, wisdom as to what I should do.
Yeah, well, unfortunately, it's been a long time since I've done almost anything in reading up on any new developments on the ICC. It was... If I recall correctly, I could be wrong about this, but I think Eric Nielsen wrote a couple of articles for us a number of years ago on our blog, which I think everything which was once on the blog has now been posted in the archives of the blog. But there might be something. I think Rich may be looking right now. Is that what you're doing out there? He's checking. But there might be something on the International Churches of Christ on the blog. If not, I'm sure there probably is at some of the organizations like Personal Freedom Outreach. It's not one of the areas that we focus upon or have done any debates on or anything like that, other than to recognize that the guy that started it was named Kip something, as I recall.
Yeah, Kip. I forget his last name, but yeah, he was weird.
I can't hear you, Rich. I'm sorry.
Kip Kinkle.
Kinkle? That doesn't sound right. That doesn't sound right to me, but anyway. Was there something up there? Was there something on our website from Eric Nielsen or anything? Not there? Okay. Anyway, Personal Freedom Outreach, maybe CARM, some of those groups might have some specifics on the ICC, the people who keep an eye on their recent developments, but they really should be distinguished from the mainline Churches of Christ, which do have some, obviously there's some serious problems, the old line Church of Christ, as far as almost getting to the point of Pelagianism and baptismal regeneration and all that kind of stuff. But a lot of Churches of Christ that aren't ICC have somewhat liberalized and somewhat backed off from some of those things. So there is a distinction that needs to be brought there. But yeah, they will utilize that kind of pressure to keep conversation from happening. And it does sound like your friends are in a situation of out of the frying pan into the fire. And the problem is that the same kind of works orientation that was very much a part of Roman Catholicism, they just went right back to it in a bare bones version in the ICC version of it. So what can you do about that? Well, it sounds, from the way you described it, it almost sounds like your friend, the husband, isn't really in charge as far as spiritually goes in the
couple. He's not. He's very quiet. And he's very passive.
Okay.
So his wife is the opposite. She's very aggressive, and she holds, I don't know, she's very, I don't know.
Yeah, that's going to even make it harder. You can try to keep this. By the way, it's Kip McKean. Thank you to Abu Kamar on Twitter. You can try to keep avenues open with him apart from her, but you know, and not so much, I wouldn't so much focus on original sin as I would upon the positive element, which is the power of grace, you know, issues related to man's deadness and sin, things
right.
like that. But, you know, if she just slams the door, all you can pray is that that door will eventually come open simply because there's a real weariness with having gone from work salvation system to another work salvation system.
Mm-hmm.
But yeah, it's a tough situation they're in. No two ways about it.
Yeah. Well, thank you for your help, Dr. White.
Okay. Thanks, Jeremy. Thanks for your call.
Take care.
All right. God bless.
God bless.
877-753-3341. Let's talk with Danny. Hi, Danny.
Hey, good afternoon, Dr. White. I have a very short question. It's on the fig tree, but don't worry, it's from a Christian perspective. I just wanted to ask how you understand Mark 11:13 without disputing, you know, while still agreeing that it's a physically acted out metaphor of sorts, being that the text seems to say that he wanted to see if there was any fruit on the tree. Should we still interpret this within a diophysite framework as still referring to the limitations on his human nature? That's just the question.
No, I think that the whole issue of the fig tree, it says he went to see if perhaps he would find anything on it. Jesus obviously knew what the season for figs was. This was a fig tree that had given indication by being in leaf. And the whole point, we have to understand that both Matthew and Mark place this in the same context, and they're communicating the same thing. Everyone understood that the fig tree had relationship to the people of Israel. If you read the parables, remember in Matthew, you're going to have Matthew 23. You're going to have everything that happens as far as in the temple precincts. It seems very, very clear that what is being communicated is this is a symbol for the people of Israel, and it looks like something that it is not. And so I think trying to read anything more into it and going, oh, Jesus really wanted to eat figs, and he didn't get any, and that was just the limitation of his knowledge or anything like that. I think both Matthew and Mark would sort of look at you and go, you're overreading me a bit, brother. Just look at the whole message and you'll get it, type of a thing, I think is what both of them would say at that point. So I just don't see any reason to go beyond that because of the application it's made.
Okay. May I ask one really quick question?
Sure.
It's the question about the Trinity, being that William Lane Craig, in his writings, he's adamant about how the three persons within the Trinity, none of them are individually identical to God. I was just curious what your position on that is. Would you say that each person is identical to the one God, or would you take a position like his? And that's all.
Well, I'm not even sure what that's supposed to mean. Identical to the one God? You mean the being of God? I see a fundamental misapprehension of the distinction between being and person in the question.
Well, Dr. Craig's position would be that, so you have one God that comprises three persons, and I guess he would take the position, it comes up in his Philosophical Foundations for a Christian World, where, for example, he doesn't say explicitly this, but, for example, no single person is tri-personal, so then if there's an attribute that God has that no individual person has, and therefore he's adamant that no individual person is like identical, logically identical to the one God that comprises the three persons. I'm just curious where you stand on that.
I don't understand the statement, so I can't really comment on it.
Okay.
I really don't. I mean, the being of God and the persons of God. Look, I have criticized the good Dr. Craig when he used the example of Kerberos for the Trinity in a debate with a Muslim. I'm just like, excuse me? That is just a wildly inaccurate analogy. And so I've voiced some concerns, and I've forgotten the specifics of it right now because I've not spent much time with it, but I also think that he has a rather unique Christological issue that I've forgotten what it is, but that he takes a rather unusual Christological stance on certain things. So maybe that has something to do with what he's insisting on there. I really don't know.
Okay.
All right. Thank you.
Thank you, sir.
All right. God bless. Bye-bye. 877-753-3341. I bet you're not writing any of these down, so I'm not even going to bother to try to remember them, but that's okay. Let's go to Waco, Texas. Hi, Kenneth.
Hi, Dr. White. Thank you for taking my call.
Yes, sir.
I was calling in hopes of perhaps getting just some pointers or resource recommendations. I've spent most of my adult life as a Christian involved with more secularist environments, particularly those in academia. And you spend enough time in that, and you start to learn the hot issues that come up, but also, most importantly, the foundational presuppositions and worldview issues. Rather recently, I've kind of been transplanted more into an environment where I'm surrounded by theological liberalism, and I'm kind of rushing to catch up on things like attacks against inerrancy, against the doctrine of hell, and things like that. But I'm having a lot of trouble addressing some of the more foundational presuppositions that go into that. I'm wondering if, like we would see with dealing with atheists and agnostics, if you had any recommendations on what I ought to be reading if I'm surrounded by theological liberals at this time.
Well, a number of things. It's older, but it's foundational. Machen's Christianity and Liberalism, his book on the Virgin Birth, both of them coming out of that time period where some of the best minds in the Christian faith were interacting with classical liberalism. In my experience, theological liberalism today has become more like the same kind of cultural leftism, where it's not so much liberal in the sense of allowing for multiple perspectives. It's adopted the same kind of totalitarian perspective to where if you're in most liberal seminaries today, you're not even going to hear what the old, maybe traditional or conservative perspective is on almost any issue. It's just going to be dismissed as, well, yeah, people used to believe that, but we all know that they thought that the Bible was inerrant too, and so they thought you could actually believe these things, and it's just sort of dismissed. That certainly was my experience, even back in the 80s at Fuller, my perspective wasn't really given any opportunity of expression. It was every other perspective that was allowed to have most of the time. And that's only gotten worse over time, depending on the school you're at or the context in which you're finding yourself. So, back then anyways, there was still meaningful interaction. There's very rarely meaningful interaction from the liberal perspective. And on the conservative side, certainly other than Machen, On a real nuts and bolts side, I've found Gleason Archer's book on Encyclopedia of Bible Difficulties to be very useful, just simply to get some foundational background information on certain issues, not worldview issues and things like that, just nuts and bolts type stuff. And then as far as other areas, well, I actually have read a lot of things. Heresy of Orthodoxy, I think, is going to be stuff. If you look at the Heresy of Orthodoxy, and then you look in the bibliographies of books that are being cranked out by folks like Dr. Michael Kruger and I don't have it in here. I have mainly heresy in this room, unfortunately, but. Who's the other guy on Heresy of Orthodoxy? Kruger and the other editor. I can't remember off the top of my head. But anyways, if you look into the bibliographies of some of those books, you're going to find a whole lot more reading that you might want to be doing along those lines. I've mentioned in the past, for example, I read a book. Israel Amongst the Gods or something like that, that was on archaeology and the reliability of the Old Testament text. There's all sorts of materials like that that generally you pick up in footnotes and bibliographies and stuff like that. Kostenberger, that's the other. Kistemacher, Kostenberger, they all start with a K. But you might find those to be good resources to get some more foundational materials with. I, on an apologetic level, I still think Bahnsen's Every Thought Captive is extremely helpful in resisting movement toward the liberal side of things as well.
Yeah, I've enjoyed that one quite a bit.
Good.
But the other stuff, then, I think you've given me quite a bit of material to keep me busy for a while, so I appreciate that.
All righty. Thank you.
God bless. Bye-bye.
God bless. Bye-bye. 877-753-3341. I don't know. We've got three calls. That's probably going to take us the rest of the time here, but let's talk with Jackie. Hi, Jackie.
Hey, Dr. White. I'm glad I finally got to talk to you. My question is Islam, and I just want you to know I study your debates over and over, and they have been tremendous educational-wise, and I really do want to learn this because for the mere fact that, you know, you want these people to be saved. But you know, the thing that I noticed is, you know, if you cut right to the chase and you talk about paradise and heaven, and there's just no comparison. And I really wonder if, I mean, do you, in your experience, do you think that most Muslims really understand what is supposedly waiting for them? And if they do, shouldn't that be like a red flag to them that there's something very carnal and wrong about their, you know, the writings of the Quran? And I don't want to offend any of them, but the way it's written, it's so clear that man has written the Quran. I mean, if you're someone that studies the Bible, it's so clear. In fact, I sometimes wonder if he made it up as he went along, and I'm not trying to be rude, but that's just after, you know, considerable study and looking at it. But when you look at the fact that most of the people in hell are women, and the men, it's just all carnal desires. What's your experience on this? Because that really floors me that they still believe, just in the fact that paradise and heaven are so different.
Yeah, I was a little taken aback a couple of years ago listening to a debate with Shabir Ali, and some of these issues came up, and he actually said that that you can exercise more discipline and restraint in these issues here on earth, knowing that once you get to heaven, you're going to be able to not be restrained any longer. And it does strike me that there is a vast disconnect there when you really think about it. What our desires here on earth should only be even more greatly what our desire is in heaven. So if our desire is to be disciplined here on earth, then the idea that somehow we would overthrow that or throw that off in heaven. Yeah, there's a fundamental difference in what we believe our relationship with God is going to be. But that really goes back to the foundational reality that as much as Muslims may want to speak about relationship with Allah, there is no relationship with Allah. Allah is utterly transcendent. You may make your prayers, but the fundamental thing that Islam is rejecting in Christianity is the nearness and intimacy of relationship with God that the atonement indicates and the incarnation indicates. And so that ends up flowing into our views of what paradise would be. And for the Christian, you know, when I talk with Jehovah's Witnesses and they ask about heaven and stuff like that, I say, well, I can't give you the physical location of heaven, but I can tell you one thing. For a Christian, it's wherever Christ is. And I'm going to be with him. He has gone to prepare a place for me. And being in his presence, wherever you want to locate that, that's where it's going to be for me because of that personal relationship and the worship that I want to be able to experience in that situation. So there is a fundamental difference there. But no, until the Spirit of God is active, that kind of contradiction is just simply not going to necessarily come into the mind of someone.
Yeah, I understand that. We understand that the Holy Spirit, you know, opens our eyes. And I these debates, at first I couldn't understand, well, what's the point of the debate? But then as I see it, you know, as far as changing the other person's mind, but they were so educational. But it just appears that, I don't know if their mind just doesn't, I mean, their God is so small compared to our God. And just the fact that they can't understand him entering into his own creation, as you would say. And I just feel like there's a line drawn as far as the education. It just really blows my mind that they don't grasp this. And
yeah, well, no, you know, until it's made a subject of conversation, you know, obviously the Spirit of God could cause them to think through something like that. But for most people, if they're not under conviction, then it's just not something that's going to necessarily jump out and say something to them. So I got a couple others to get through real quick. I appreciate the call today, Jackie.
Okay, thanks.
All right,
bye-bye.
All right, goodbye. All right, let's try to sneak the last two in here. We may go a little bit long, but that's, hey, we're not on a network. We don't have to worry about it too much. Let's talk with Ashley. Hi, Ashley.
Hey, Dr. White.
How are you?
Hi. Yeah, very good, very good. Big fan of the show. And I actually have a lot of your books adorning my my bookshelf at the moment. So, yeah, great work.
Well, good. Thank you.
Yeah, no problem. Yeah, the question I have revolves around basically everything that you see in the Old Testament. From what I can see, so the circumcision, circumcision seems to be a representation of the circumcision of the heart. The blood that you see across the doors of the people in Egypt represents the fact that through those who are justified, Jesus' blood will cover them. Basically, what I'm asking about is the animal sacrifice that was done in the Old Testament. Did that actually cover sins, or were they merely a representation of the sacrifice of Christ's death on the cross?
Well, I think the answer is given in Romans and Hebrews. Both Hebrews, of course, specifically says there is no forgiveness of sins in the blood of goats and bulls and calves. So why do this? Well, as Paul explains in Romans 3, in talking about Christ Jesus, says in verse 25, whom God displayed publicly as a propitiation in his blood through faith, this was to demonstrate his righteousness, because in the forbearance of God, he passed over the sins previously committed for the demonstration, I say, of his righteousness at the present times, so he would be just and the justifier of the one who has faith in Jesus. So, what you have is the idea that in light of the certainty of the sacrifice of Christ, in light of the certainty of the cross, God passes over the sins previously committed. Now, if they had been quote-unquote atoned for by some other mechanism other than the blood of Christ, then they wouldn't have to be passed over. But there is no atonement in the blood of goats and bulls and calves, but they point forward to that finished work of Christ, and it's faith in God's promises that has always been the foundation of a person's relationship with Christ, and the cross being the center point of history. Now we look back upon that. Those before the cross look forward to that. We obviously are able to see with much more clarity looking back than they could looking forward. But the point is that the cross was an absolute necessity to fulfill the grounds upon which God had been propitious and gracious to those who had come before who had believed in him. And it has to be the same ground, the same ground for those who came before, the same ground for those who come after the cross. It's all faith, and it's all the sacrifice of Christ.
Awesome. So essentially, it's the same mechanism. So whether before Christ's incarnation and death and resurrection, or after, we're justified in the same way.
Well, as far as the grounds goes, yes. As far as our knowledge of that, obviously, being afterwards, we have the great advantage of a much clearer revelation, a much clearer knowledge of what God has done. But as far as the basis upon which anyone will ever stand before God, given that the standard is perfection, it has to be the same ground.
Awesome. Thank you
for your call, sir.
Cheers, no problem.
All right, God bless. Bye-bye. All right, one last one. Let's talk to Marie. Hi, Marie.
Hi.
Hi.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call.
Yes.
I've got a quick question about Islam. I have a couple of really good friends who are Muslims. First and foremost, they are friends. And because they're friends, we do get into conversations. And one thing they have said that I can't find answered anywhere is that Jesus didn't mean everything he said. And I don't know how to answer that. And I wondered if you could help me with where they're coming from.
Jesus didn't mean everything he said.
Yeah. Never heard it before.
No. Nope.
I've watched lots of debates and things.
Yeah, and I've done lots of debates. Never heard that one either. So I'd need a context. I don't know what they mean by that.
Well, I can't think of the conversation generally now, and some of it was confidential, but we were just talking generally, and when I speak naturally, I don't even realize I'm doing it half the time, but I will quote the Lord and what he said. I will quote the Bible. And I said, oh, yeah, but, you know, well, Jesus said. So, and the response was, oh, yeah, but Jesus didn't mean everything that he said.
I have a feeling that what they're probably talking about, this is my best guess, is many Muslims will say that Jesus spoke metaphorically. And so, for example, when he said he was the Son of God, he didn't really mean he was the Son of God. He was just saying he was a godly man or something along those lines. That's fairly common. I've yet to meet a Muslim who was even semi-close to consistent in how they made application of that, or had any idea how you could tell the difference between a metaphorical statement or a factual statement or anything else. And fundamentally what they were doing was, well, anything that Jesus said that doesn't fit into the misunderstandings of the author of the Quran has to be taken metaphorically and couldn't be taken literally. That would be the only guess I could give you as to what they're actually referring to, is that they're basically saying that there were things that Jesus said that were meant to be taken metaphorically, not literally.
Right.
And at that point, you have to go, well, what are your rules for determining that? I mean, can I not just simply say that you mean that metaphorically and you don't really mean it? Obviously, you do really mean it. There has to be something, you know, when Jesus says, I am the door, there's something in the context that indicates that he's giving us a metaphor. He's using words to communicate something. But when he says, I am the Son of God, and quotes from Old Testament passages at his trial, and the Jewish leaders tear their robes and accuse him of blasphemy and he should die, he doesn't say, oh, no, you didn't understand. I was taking it metaphorically. No, he knows that at this point of time is not the time for metaphors. He's being very straightforward and he accepts their understanding. So there has to be, there are rules in language that help us to understand what is a metaphor and what is not. You can't just simply say,
right.
If I don't like what someone's saying, I'll just say it's a metaphor. So I would, that's the only thing I could think that they're possibly communicating to you at that point.
Right.
Okay.
Okay. Yeah, I mean, I did wonder whether she meant something like parables or, but no, that wasn't, okay, metaphorically. Yeah. All right. Well, okay. Thank you very much for your
All
time.
Right.
I appreciate that.
Thanks for your call, Marie.
Thanks very much.
All right. Bye-bye. Yeah, bye-bye. All right. Probably right now my thinking is that we are going to have to do the program on Monday. I fly out on Tuesday. It's not till Tuesday evening, but I'm going to have 16 billion things going on. So we'll probably be looking at a dividing line on Monday of next week.
And then I've got John Sampson lined up for Thursday and then the following Tuesday. And then I believe we got another Tuesday, Thursday that you'll be gone after that, or a Thursday, Tuesday, really. And I'm going to do those shows.
Yeah. Okay.
I'm so going
should we warn a certain person in Texas?
Oh, I think he listens anyway. He's
no,
out there
I don't think
waiting,
so. I don't think so.
But no, I will be picking up the cross examination sections of that particular debate, and moving my way forward.
So we've got the 5th and the 10th with John, and then the 12th, and maybe the 17th. I do get back on the 17th. So okay, all right, yeah, that works.
Yeah, well, I kind of figured that you wouldn't exactly be landing and then running in here ready to go, and I think you actually land early evening anyway. So
2:40 maybe.
Oh well, then there's plenty of time. After a little jet lag, no big deal. Let's do another jet lag dividing line. Right?
Belfast to Heathrow here.
No big deal.
No problem at all. Yeah. That is assuming all my flights actually.
Oh
work.
Yeah, well, so yeah. Who knows where you'll actually wind up?
That's right. All righty, so that's what's coming up, folks. So next time, Monday, probably around this time. On Monday is when we'll get together again. Thanks for listening. We'll see you then. God bless.